The Chinese, like the ancient Egyptians, buried the powerful and the rich with great pomp and many possessions. China buried her wealthy and her powerful not only with their own possessions, but also with hundreds and sometimes thousands of little wooden or clay figurines, which represented the world in which that man or woman had lived out their life. When a Chinese tomb is opened, they often find 6-inch-high, 3-foot-high figurines of the nobleman's wives and concubines, the attendants at his courts, the slaves and peasants who worked in his fields, models of his palace and of his farms and of his granaries, models of his cavalry and his own favorite horse, his hawk, almost anything that a man or woman might have enjoyed in this world is symbolized in this way as accompanying him into the next life. The oldest surviving Chinese painting dates from the 10th century of our era. These armies of varied forms, these figurines, reach back another 1,000 years and allow us to get a picture, a visual image, of costume, of architecture, of means of transportation, of the animals and the people of China during the first 10 centuries and more of this era. Now, the ancient Chinese, like the ancient Hebrews and all who depended upon our biblical tradition, looked upon their world as a center of the world. Jews and later the Christians looked on Jerusalem as the very center of the universe. And the Chinese called their empire the Middle Kingdom. And such was the power and the wealth and the extent, the achievement of their empire, that they felt little, if any, need to go out and to explore the rest of the world. The Chinese, for the most part, were content to allow the world to come to them. Ambassadors from other countries to bring tribute, traders from other countries to bring their goods and their silver to barter or exchange for the paper that China had invented, for the silk which China had first learned to manufacture, for that elixir of all drinks, tea, for Chinese porcelain, for any of the other of the goods of China which the world so much coveted. And among the figures which you will find in a number of the royal and imperial tombs are figures of heavily laden camels that trudged their way across the great silk routes of Asia, and figures of the traders who accompanied the camels, traders with long costumes fit for the road, traders with very Semitic faces, traders who are representations from the 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th centuries, among others, of the first Jews to cross the world and enter China. There were probably Jews in China as early as the 1st or 2nd century of our era. There were certainly Jewish traders in China by the 5th and 6th centuries of this era. There were two ways to trade with China, from India and Southeast Asia by sea to the eastern ports, and then up the rivers to the great capital cities, or from the Middle East and Persia across the roof of the world, from Persia, from Tashkent, across the Russian steppes into Turkestan, and from there into China. Most of the Jews who came to China came by this second road, by land, and settlement soon followed trade. We tend to think of China as a country which sealed itself off from the rest of the world. And it's certainly true that in our medieval times and in pre-modern times, the Ming and the Qing dynasties, the last two great long-lived dynasties of China, in fact tended to build walls against the outside world. Oh, there were always communities of foreigners in China, but time and again during this medieval period, the Chinese tried to uproot those who were bringing alien ideas. First, they attacked the Buddhists, and then they attacked the Catholic priests who were there. And then in 1734, the Chinese government ordered all European traders, missionaries, out of China. But during the first 10 centuries or so of our era, China was rather eager to have the traders and the visitors and the travelers to learn what could be learnt of the rest of the world, to satisfy its own the curiosity of the scholar class, to have them bring whatever instruments and technical devices that they had developed and their silver and their gold for Chinese trade. And it was during these long centuries that Arabs, Indians, and Persians, and Jews came and settled. We know that as early as 1132, a synagogue was dedicated in the Sung capital of China, Kaifeng. Now, I would not have liked to have had the insurance business on this synagogue. We know that in the course of its 700-year history, it burnt down several times. It was destroyed by flood several times. There were a number of other natural and political disasters which overcame it. But for at least 800 years, Jews were affiliated with this synagogue. And whenever there was a rebuilding, as is the custom in China, a great stone tablet, a stele, was raised. A stele which thanked God for his guardianship of this community, a stele which praised the emperor in very tactful terms for his support, a stele which mentioned the leaders of the community and the major donors to the rebuilding. Plaques on walls were known in China as well as in the United States. One of these stele from the year 1498, a stele which commemorates the rebuilding of this synagogue from one of the great floods which overwhelmed it and destroyed it temporarily, tells us that the community was led by a rabbi who was called in Chinese Vushudu, which apparently is a transliteration of a Persian loan word. Persia was the lingua franca, the common language of the traders between the Middle East and China. The Persian word is ustad. It means a teacher, a mentor, a learned man. This community seems to have numbered into the many thousands. It had its rabbi, and it also had an official who was the official responsible for the synagogue, who was called the manla. This man seems to have been a combination shochet, religious slaughterer, sofer, the one who writes the Torah scrolls, and shamus, the general factotum around a synagogue. And the word manla is an interesting one because, again, it seems to come from a foreign source. It's the same word as mullah, which most of us have become familiar with in recent times from reading about Iran. A mullah is a minor Muslim religious official who is responsible in a small area for the ordinary events of the religious life. And it's not surprising that a Jewish official with very specific Jewish tasks should be given a name which is obviously borrowed from the Arabs. The Chinese always had a great deal of difficulty separating out, distinguishing between the two great Unitarian traditions, Islam and Judaism, which had come into their country. Indeed, one of the names by which Jews were called in China is the name which translates to be the blue-turbaned Muslims. The Muslims wore a white turban, the Jews wore a blue turban, and this was simply one easy means of identifying the Jews almost as a Muslim sect. Now, these Jews of Kaifeng, and there were Jews in Chang'an, which is today Xi'an, which was then one of the great capitals of China. There were Jews in Hangzhou and Suzhou. There were Jews in many of the major cities in China. These Jews were rabbinic Jews. They maintained some of the dietary laws. One of the other names by which they were known is the people who pluck the sinew. They had their Sefer Torahs. They maintained the whole calendar of holidays as we do. They observe the Sabbath. They practice circumcision. They even solve the problem of emperor worship. In China, whatever denomination, whatever group you were belonged to, whatever shrine you worshipped at, you had to perform a formal act of obedience, of genuflection to the emperor. And in almost in every Chinese shrine, there was a royal plaque with the emperor's name high up on the ceiling. And as you entered, you bowed to this plaque. But what was the Jew to do? The law which says you shall not bend the knee to any idol or any but the King of Kings. And the answer was very simple. They raised high the emperor's plaque, and above the plaque they put another plaque which had on it, Shema Yisrael Adonai Eloheinu Adonai Echad. We bow the head and bend the knee to the King of Kings, the Holy One, praised be He. Now if you pick up encyclopedias or history books, you may see a picture, a photograph taken around the turn of the century of the Jews of China. And what you're likely to see is a picture of four or five rather impoverished Chinese gentlemen, rather bedraggled, the remnants of this community of Kaifeng. These, by 1900, these remnants of the Jews of China hardly knew what being Jewish meant. All they had was the memory of what the elders had told them when they were young. There were no Jewish practices, there was no formal Jewish structure or Jewish institution. But until the 19th century, Jewish life had survived and indeed survived and thrived. Now, I did not go to China to look for new employment as a wushudu. You couldn't make a living as a rabbi in China. Once the high walls of separation were built up between China and the West, once centuries passed without the Jews of Kaifeng or Hangzhou meeting a Jewish traveler, meeting anyone from the outside, the forces of acculturation, of assimilation, and of numbers simply began to exert their toll. There's a critical mass in religious sociology as well as in physics. And when a community falls below a certain number, it ceases to be able to provide wives for its young men, husbands for its young women, teachers for its children, all the human beings who are necessary for the survival of the generations. We were in a city called Kunming. Kunming is in Yunnan province in the very south of China. We were there early in our trip when the Chinese were still celebrating their two-week New Year festival. Kunming is a lovely city known to many Americans because it was in Kunming that the famous Burma Road had its Chinese terminus. Now, I'm a wanderer. I don't get herded into groups very easily. I'm also one who does not like to waste time with the more formal parts of the day. I found that there were travelers to China with us in the little group we had. You have to travel in China with a group who had to eat three meals a day. And they had to eat three long vilek meals every day. And over the long lunch hour, I had a habit of strolling off and, you know, wandering by myself and seeing what could be seen. And on one of these strolls in Kunming, I walked down a canal near the, about a mile or so from the hotel. And I noticed as I passed one's courtyard entrance that someplace deep in that courtyard there was a big red emblem, an embroidery hanging from a second floor balcony. And being a curious sort, I walked in. And there were a number of children playing in the courtyard, and some people came up and obviously were welcoming me to come in further. And as I looked at this big red flag, I saw suddenly the crescent on the flag, and underneath it in Arabic, the words Allah Akbar, God is great. I had found a mosque, and I walked into the mosque, which looked from the outside like any other rather small Buddhist or Confucian lecture hall. Wood latticed, wood pillared. And as I walked up the steps to this building, I noticed on the left and on the right, on the sides of the porch, which were plastered, that someone had painted two postal card scenes, one of Mecca and one of Medina, the two great cities in Muhammad's life. And the shamus of the mosque was kind enough to open the doors for me, and there inside was a mihrab and a reader's desk and these Turkish or Chinese rugs, you know, prayer rugs on the floor. And as best I could, I found that, yes, the mosque was still being used. Yes, it was one of four mosques in Kunming, and regular worship took place here. Well, for a rabbi, this raises an interesting question. Why had the Muslim community survived in China and not the Jewish community? And I suspect that there are several answers. One has to do with numbers. There were never more than 20, 30,000 Jews in all of China, and there were sometimes perhaps as many as 500,000 or 750,000 Muslims in China. One has to do with geography. The Jews who came to China had to come the long land route. There are major Muslim communities in India and Southeast Asia, much closer to China, and the access was always easier for Muslim groups to come in. And I think the third reason has to do with the nature of the faith itself. Islam, when it came into China, was an imperialistic faith. That is, it was a faith which still bent on a world mission. It had a world vision and still does, to make all men see and women see the truth that Muhammad taught, the truth of the Quran, the truth of Islam. But when Jews came to China, by the time Jews came to China, we'd already had the imperialistic part of our tradition knocked out of us. We were a missionary faith in the early centuries before the Common Era, but with the great defeats of the first and second century, when the Jews rebelled and against Rome and were so viciously and violently defeated in the year 70 and again during the Bar Kokhba rebellion, we lost our elan, we lost our drive, because it was now impolitic for Jews, a minority faith, always a minority within another dominant religious tradition, to go out and to seek converts. It was worth the missionary's life and the convert's life. And so the Islamic world of China was a missionary world and remains so to this day. And I suspect that the Jews of China were simply Jews, content to live among themselves, dependent upon occasional other groups of their co-religionists coming from abroad. And when these ceased to come, there was a slow atrophy, a slow disintegration, and finally, disappearance. These mosques, and the fact that there were regular worship at these mosques, raised for a rabbi another question. What about religion in China? Has communism in China effectively erased all traces of the traditional religious practices? And here I must say that I was surprised by the degree of attendance and worship which we found, particularly in southern China, at the various shrines. I had heard from earlier visitors that the shrines were deserted, that many of the buildings were simply abandoned, that you could see them from the roadside as ruins, and all that is true, particularly in the north. Many of the old temple compounds have been turned into public parks, and the shrine buildings into libraries or other meeting rooms of the same of some kind or other. But in southern China, at least during this New Year's period when we were there, whenever we came to a Buddhist or a Taoist shrine, we found not only tourists, but worshippers, not only the elderly, but the middle-aged and the young. Generally, since it was the springtime, they were bringing offerings of branches of flowering trees, flower petals, and they were burning joss sticks, little incense sticks, in the great urns that are before the shrines. And when you went into the shrine itself and stood before the great figure of one of the seated Buddhas, or the many figures of the Lohans, the wise men of the Taoist tradition, you found that the individual worshiper would come, bend, pray, and light a candle, very much the way you see candles lit in a Catholic church before one of the the icons of one of the statues. There's worship in China. I was surprised at the extent, and I must say that so were our guides. You cannot travel in China on your own. You're always accompanied by a representative of the Chinese Tourist Bureau. And in addition to the national representative who remains with you during your trip, local guides appear in the various cities. And the guides told us in Kunming and Chengdu and Nanning, the southern cities that we visited, they told us that this was really the first year in which there were any number of religionists, as opposed to just tourists, visiting these temples and these shrines. And they made much of the fact of the relaxation of domestic pressures now that the Cultural Revolution is behind. And I want to come back to that question, because to me it was the most fascinating question which we came to grips with in China. How different is China now that Mao is dead? How different is China now that the Cultural Revolution is history? And a new period, a period which seems to be more open to the West, certainly more willing to accept tourists, where people can again go to the shrines. How different is this period from what existed in China before? But certainly there was, on the religious level, a relaxation. And it was symbolized for me by a temple that we visited in the western hills outside Kunming. The compound is walled. On the west side, there's a great shrine. On the east side, there's a very large, open meeting area. We first entered the west shrine and looked at the lohans, looked at the guardian figures, saw all the things that tourists have taken to see, and there's some very beautiful images and icons, you know, throughout. And the place was thronged with the pious. And interestingly, I met in one of the rooms where there were, 50 or 100 images of various of the Taoist saints on the walls, a man, late 70s, who came up to me and began to talk in good English, and who asked me if I was impressed by what I was seeing and if I believed that people actually worshipped. And I said, yes, I was impressed, and yes, I thought that they were worshipping. And to sort of add authority to what I was saying, you know, I'm a rabbi, and I know a little bit about what worship is. And we started talking, and he turned out to be a graduate of Ohio State University. Class of 1924, field aeronautic engineering, who had made the mistake of going back to China in 1936 or 1937, and who now was acting as shamus in this Taoist shrine, the call for 75-year-old aeronautical engineers in China being rather limited. But what was interesting to me about this walled compound is that while all this touring and worshiping was taking place in the West Wing, over here in the East Wing, the Young Communist League of one of the local towns was having a temple picnic. There were tugs of war, and hop, skip, and jump games, and prizes, and there was no tension between the two. No one over here was making a list, you know, of just who was going into worship over there, and nobody over here was looking over his shoulder to see if the Young Communist League, who were, after all, the most ideological of all the Chinese. We sometimes forget that less than 5% of the adult Chinese population are members of the Communist Party. Nobody was looking to see, you know, if they were being noted down or watched. Just how different is China since Mao? We must remember that anything I say is limited by the limits of experience. In China, you see to a very large degree what the Chinese want you to see. That is the Chinese government. I do not speak Chinese. Our contacts were limited to those who could speak English with us. Most of those who spoke English with us spoke as officials, spoke because they had a task that had been assigned to it. In China, even if you have the name, address, and telephone number of someone whom you want to see, you're not always allowed to make contact with that person. We had several such names, and somehow we're sorry. We just don't know quite how to arrange it, and somehow the 2 days or 3 days you're going to be in this town pass by, and you never make contact. Your contacts with English-speaking people on the street do exist. English is being taught to many Chinese in most of the schools, and many are eager to practice their Chinese on you, but obviously you can't have a deep philosophic discussion while standing on a street corner, and the Chinese government prohibits the entry of ordinary Chinese citizens into the tourist hotels. Every hotel is a compound. There are guards at the gate, and if you want to go out and visit with someone whom you've met, you have to go out of the gate and talk on the street corner. You can't simply invite them in for a drink. They will not be allowed in. So there are, what, 1 billion Chinese? We talk to 50. How much can you really, really know? But these are my impressions for what they're worth. The Cultural Revolution is over. Mao was right. The contradictions of Chinese society remain despite the Communist Revolution. That is to say, there is still the distinction between intellectual work and menial work, between the old scholar class, the university students, and the peasants. You are part of the elite if you're in the scholar class. You're an ordinary Chinaman if you're a peasant. The whole question of status, of class, exists in China. There's a class of privilege. There are no private cars in China. There are great taxis in most cities which you can hire, but there's also in every city a fleet of big, black, 9-passenger Chinese Cadillacs, complete with curtains on the windows and Turkish rugs on the floor, in which the elite of China move back and forth from one meeting or one place to another. And I'm sure their homes are equally distinctive from the rather cramped, limited quarters of the average Chinese worker. It's not an egalitarian society. And those who are of privilege obviously try to pass on their privileges to their children. And Mao was an ideologue. Mao was a true believer. Mao was eager to resolve these contradictions, and that's the whole basis of the Cultural Revolution, to destroy the difference between the menial worker, the man who works with his hands, and the man who works with his mind, to destroy the contradiction between the traditional reverence for aged and the importance of youth, to destroy the contradiction between the traditional reverence for the man and traditional subordinate status for the woman, to resolve these contradictions. He tried to force a society which would see to it that all participated in hard work, that the privileged had to have their turn at the bottom of the scale as well as at the top. But in the process, he almost destroyed China. He absolutely destroyed the training of a generation of young people who would be able to be the experts and the scientists and the technicians who would allow China to develop industrially. He made it impossible for universities to continue their work, because you can't simply take a peasant and tell him to teach nuclear physics. It is just physically impossible. And so China was almost brought to its knees by the kind of convulsive activity that the Great Leap Forward and then the Cultural Revolution entailed. And Mao's theoretical correctness had to be undone by more practical men who are now in the governance of China. And the only way that they knew how to do this, how to accomplish this, was to relax tensions for a while, to allow things to settle down, to allow the youth from the universities who had been sent to the far places to work with their hands to come back to the universities and to complete their work, to allow the university professors who, instead of being in the libraries, were in the rice paddies, to leave the rice paddies and return to the libraries, to allow those who knew how to manage the factories of China, who'd been sent to do some other kind of work and had been replaced by ideologues, to replace the ideologues and allow the factory to begin production again. Something had to be given to all Chinese to signal this new world, and what they did was to allow a free market to develop in China. To the peasant, they said, you can take a certain small percentage of the land that you work, of the land of the commune, and it will be yours. And whatever you raise on this land, you can sell, and the money you can use to buy what you need. And to the worker in the city, they said, once you have worked on your shifts in the commune factory, you can go out on the street and have a stall where you can repair shoes, or you can weave cloth, or you can sell something that you make in your household. And whatever you make from this stall, from this work, will be yours to buy what you need. And on those small plots which the Chinese farmers were allowed to own, they began to raise 50% more food than they managed somehow to raise in the large commune plots per acre. And somehow people began to invest themselves energetically in the stalls on the streets to a degree that they had not invested themselves in the work in the factory. And wherever you go, and wherever we went in China, we saw this free market. And interestingly, our guides, though they were obviously chosen because they were members of the party, you know, and were people whose ideology could be trusted, were eager to buy in the stalls of the free market rather than the stalls of the commune commissaries. And I asked them why. And the answer is, you get a better grade of food. Less food has to be thrown out as inedible. So they allowed a certain freedom to develop within the context of Chinese society. So we have on the one hand evidence of religious relaxation of religious proscription, on another hand evidence of relaxation of economic strictures, of the enforced labor that was the hallmark of communist China during the early years. And many who have come back to China have come back feeling that China has entered a new era, and then we can expect further and further relaxations, and the normal capitalistic, dare I use the word, the normal free enterprise, the normal greed, the normal energies of the Chinese people to develop and express themselves. I don't think so. I'm not convinced that Mao, that China after Mao is that different than China under Mao. I'm not convinced that the Chinese Communist Party is seriously relaxing its grip. You saw much evidence of this. In the first giddy days after the Cultural Revolution, you'll recall that they allowed freedom walls to appear in all the major cities. And on these walls, any Chinese citizen could put up a poster which spoke of his needs or his group's needs or complained about the abuses that they had endured under this or that party hack. Well, the freedom walls have disappeared from every Chinese city. We were told that there one remains in Peking, but it's someplace in the outskirts. And every time I asked to see the outskirt freedom wall, the issue was skirted. I never got there, and I don't believe it exists, though there may be a 2x4 piece of stone someplace marked Freedom Wall and with two policemen guarding it. About 4 months before we visited China, the Chinese televised the treason trial of several men who had made the mistake of becoming too close with some of the foreign residents of Peking. And the entire trial had been televised throughout China. And the Chinese have television sets, not only in factories and the communes, but many individuals have sets. One of the fascinating things to me was the number of television sets we saw for sale in the stores. Now, they cost 3 to 4 times what a television set costs in the United States in real terms. And if you add to that how much less the Chinese worker is paid for his daily work, you understand how costly these sets really are. But they're there. And on radio or television, the Chinese followed this trial and learned a lesson, that it's not good to become too close to anyone who is not a Chinese. And to drive home this truth, about a week after we left China, the government published a new Espionage Act, a bit of draconian legislation which essentially says that almost anything that you might say to a foreigner can be construed as revealing state secrets. Anything that you cannot prove to have been published in the official Chinese newspaper, Xinhua, that you say to a foreigner may open you to guilt as a spy. And obviously, in a country where punishments can be swift and final and involve not only your person but your whole family, people are going to be very careful in the future in terms of their relationships with non-Chinese in their own country. During the period of relaxation, the Chinese began to encourage tourism. They did so for several reasons. One, political. Tourism is an inevitable byproduct of trade, and the Chinese desperately need the advanced technology of the West. And part of the price for that technology is to allow the tourist to come along, and the advantage of the tourist is he brings hard dollars with which to pay for the whatever China wants to buy. But tourism brings people with new ideas, different perspectives, facts which the Chinese may not have heard as yet. And so the Chinese are increasingly determined to find ways to wall off the tourist from the citizen. Language is the great wall. It's one that the tourist generally cannot overcome. But unfortunately for the Chinese, now everyone who was teaching Russian Chinese 15 years ago is now teaching English. They're determined to develop a whole class of university people, of engineers and technicians and bureaucrats who know English so they can deal with us. And so there are a lot of people on the street who come up to you and put in front of you a book and say, will you read me my latest English lesson so I can hear how it should be spoken? We were in one shrine one day, and a young man came up to me and he said, will you read this lesson to me? I have a tape recorder and I want to have a way to refresh my mind from time to time on how English really sounds. The Chinese, when we were there, allowed us to exchange our money for yuan, the Chinese currency, at an arbitrary rate. And armed with yuan, you could wander through the streets and go into any restaurant or any store, buy something at a stall, start up any kind of conversation. All kinds of contacts can be made. About 3 weeks after we left China, the Chinese passed a new law which said that all tourists, all foreigners coming into China will be given script rather than yuan. And the script can be exchanged in the accredited hotels and accredited restaurants, but nowhere else. So again, you have this sense of walling the tourist in from contact with the rest of the country. China is not a free society. And I must say the Chinese do not seem to be too unhappy with that situation. One of the unexpected contradictions for a Westerner is to see smiles, a certain grace of manner, despite the poverty and the squalor that you see about you, to see a people which really does not seem to be unhappy, frustrated, embittered by what they are living through. And one of the things I think we have to understand about China is that China has never been a free society. And there's nothing in Chinese philosophy or acculturation patterns or psychological patterns which encourage the kind of rugged individualism which the West takes for granted. I don't know whether a sense of individualism will develop in China. I suspect that it's almost inevitable, particularly among those who would like to be able to use the skills they develop in their own personal advantage, but you don't sense it in the personality types. Marriage is delayed in China. Most people in China do not marry until they're in their late 20s. We met a Chinese-American woman. She'd been born in China, trained in the United States. She taught for years at the University of UCLA University. She was a child and adolescent psychiatrist and psychologist. And I tried to talk with her at some length about adolescence, growth patterns, marriage patterns, and the like. And it seemed to me just natural that if marriage is so delayed, there must either be tremendous frustration in the society, or there must be any number of illicit liaisons which are simply not sanctified by some form of religious or civil marriage. And her answer was no. Not at all. That the Chinese patiently await a marriage, that she has not found in the 3 years she's been working, she's back home and working in China in one of the clinics, she's not found evidence of tremendous frustration, and she's found very little evidence of ménages being set up, people simply living together. They're patient, that's the Chinese tradition, and it still, for the moment, governs Chinese life. How different then is China? I think as a rabbi, I was struck by the fact that to understand China, you have to understand something about messianism. We are a pragmatic society. We're looking at tomorrow, and we find it very difficult to look at the day after tomorrow. What works, works. We believe in reforms rather than revolution. That's been our tradition. We have a basic constitution which guarantees certain rights but doesn't guarantee the future. And there are very few Americans who are convinced that they know exactly how the future will work itself out. The Chinese ideologues, that is, the governing Chinese party, are cut from quite different cloth. They're not unlike the millenarians who announce from time to time that the world is going to come to an end on April 7th, 1980, and except for those who are in a particular bomb shelter in Santa Barbara, you know, the rest of the world is going to be destroyed. They know exactly how things are going to work out. They know the dialectic of history. They know the iron laws of economics. Fascinating word, iron laws of economics. The inevitable chain of events. They are confident that they know how history will work itself out. They will admit that they don't know exactly to the day when it works itself out. But they know the stages. Everything can be graphed, charted. To Deng and to those who now rule China, Mao's failure was not that he was not a good communist or an ideologue of the first order. He was both. That he was not the great charismatic founder of the state. They still revere him as that. But rather that he was what our Jewish tradition would call him a kafetz baketz. That is, one who tries to push the end, to force the hand of the Messiah, to force the Messiah to come now, to be Shabtai Tzvi. One who tries to take history and by the force of his own energy and charisma, make it happen faster than it must inevitably happen. Now, we Jews come from messianic tradition. But we always said we do not know when the Messiah will come. And we do not really know what are the antecedents of the coming of the Messiah. But there were times in our Jewish tradition, and there have been Jews and Jewish leaders who knew exactly when the Messiah would come and exactly what would be the terms which would precede his coming, and who read history exactly as the Chinese do. But when one is certain of the course of history, when Deng can say in the same speech, we welcome contact with the West. It is important for the countries of the world to meet and to exchange goods and people. And also say in that speech, the destruction of capitalism is inevitable. And before that, there it is inevitable there be a third world war, which will mark the end of the imperialist capitalist nations. You're dealing with a different kind of mind, a mind to whom relaxation is a tactic, not an end in itself. Communist ideology is what communist ideology has always been. A messianic philosophy, a messianic religion, if you will, which tells to a nation, to its devotees and disciples, that they are part of the flow of history. And just as détente to the Russians is a tactic, not an end in itself, so relaxation in these post-Mao years to the Chinese is a tactic, necessary, useful now, but not necessarily a tactic which you allow to grow and become the dominant element in the social order. If I were to make a prediction about China in the next 2 or 3 years, my prediction would be that you'll see more and more restrictions placed upon the Chinese population. The sense that the Cultural Revolution is behind has already gripped the country. The need now is to organize, not to allow disintegration, the centripetal forces to go too far, to bring everything back under control. And you're going to see all manner of attempts to achieve this. China is a very different place. And that, I think, Americans must recognize. The attitudes we bring to the normal course of our political, social, personal lives are not necessarily the attitudes that the Chinese bring to the issues which confront them. The Hebrew word for China is sin. Not sin, S-I-N, but sin. And it comes from a term used in the prophet by the prophet Isaiah in one of the great prophecies of return, of messianic redemption, when he says that when the Messiah comes, when Israel returns to Zion, we will bring the peoples from the north and from the south, even from the land of Sinin, which apparently is some land in the Middle East. But when they needed a word for China, it was the name that they had in their Bible for the furthest away and most distinct and different place. And if we keep that sense of China, perhaps we'll begin to understand China. China is a far place. Its attitudes, its whole way of life, is conditioned by history, which is quite separate from our own. Though Jews lived in China, Judaism made no impact in China. Though Muslims live in China, Islam made no impact on China. China is traditionally governed by as the individual is valued in the West. If individualism emerges in China, and that's what really we talk about when we talk about relaxation, we see the emergence, we hope we see a free enterprise of democratic forms of government, of less totalitarian forms of control. All these would depend upon the emergence of individualism, of a sense of self. A young girl who was our guide graduated in English from one of the local universities. She'd been third in her class. We asked her how she happened to be in the guide service. The answer was very simple. The first two in the class were allowed to teach the university. The next two were sent to the guide service, the next two to something else. Would she have rather done something else? I think the answer was yes. But what she really said was, what we would say when we make the best of what we have. I can't think of governing my life. That's simply not the terms of life in China. And where one of our children would have lived a life of terrible frustration, forced to go into the family business, you know, forced to do something they didn't want to do, she accepted. It was over. That's the way life is in China. And unless we accept that as a basis of understanding, and if there's any insight into China that I came away with, it was that. They're used to authority. They're graceful in their patience. Their patience is almost infinite. And anyone who expects China to become a Western oriented, Western attitude society, I think, misreads history. China, for a long period of time, is going to remain a place which we rarely see and hardly understand. And yet I would recommend for any of you that you take a trip there. It's fascinating. It's intriguing. Travel is not easy. You lose a good deal of your independence. Everybody said to me, the first question I'm asked almost always is, how free are you? And the answer is that you don't govern your schedule. You go from one city to another when you're told to go. But once you get to a city, you don't have to do all that you're told to do. You can be very American. And just when they say, we're going to see our sixth commune, you simply say to them, I don't think I'm going along and I'll do something else. And they'll say to you, but, you know, what will you do? You can't go out in the street. And you'll say, why not? And ultimately the trip will have to go on and you go out in the street and you go and you see. One can see a lot in China by just not going along. But it's only the surface. And someday I'd like to go back, and if I were a little younger, I think before I would go back, I would learn what I could of Chinese so that the language barrier would be somewhat overcome, because I'd like to learn more about this great civilization. They're going to play a major force in our world, and we'd better learn to live with them
and hopefully they may someday desire to live with us. Amen.